The title of the sermon today is Faith and Commitment. For much of the world, during most of human history, religion has been viewed as a matter of following certain rituals prescribed by the religious authorities of the society. Usually there were myths to explain why these rituals should be done, but the important thing was not whether one believed the myths. The important thing was to participate in the rituals. The Jews introduced a new idea into their religion, the idea that Yahweh, their God, required ethical behavior toward their fellow Jews. Furthermore, Yahweh had the power to reward those who followed the law given by Yahweh and punish those who did not. But the idea that what matters in religion is what you as an individual believe came with Christianity. A widespread view among Christians is that religion is basically a matter of faith, a matter of what one believes about Jesus and God and the Bible and life after death. Given the way that Christianity got started, this focus on the importance of believing certain ideas could not be avoided. Why? Because the first Christians were Jews who had different views about Jesus than most of their Jewish friends. The Christians believed that Jesus was the Messiah, the Anointed One, the Christ, which is merely the Greek word for Messiah. They believed this even though the widely accepted idea among Jews was that the Messiah would restore that nation of Israel to the great glory that it had when David and Solomon ruled the nation. After all, the Messiah was going to be the son of David. When Jesus was put to death by the Romans, this convinced most Jews that he was no one special, but rather just one more Jewish zealot who was no more successful than the others in their effort to throw off the rule of the Romans. And after all, when Jesus was crucified, what did the Romans put on the scene of the crucifixion? The King of the Jews, saying, you know, this is what happens to the King of the Jews. When the Christians claimed that Jesus was killed but nevertheless came back to life, ascended into heaven, and would soon return to establish a new kingdom superior even to the Roman Empire, the critical issue dividing the new sect from the rest of the Jewish religious community was whether to believe this claim or not. Belief was the central thing. Furthermore, those who rejected this claim about Jesus coming back to life and going up into heaven and about to return to earth were angry that such ridiculous ideas were appealing to some of their fellow Jews. The critical question now was not so much about how people acted or what rituals they practiced, but what they believed. One of the most amazing things about the Christian faith is that people continue to believe these pre-Enlightenment ideas, even though Jesus obviously did not come down from heaven, as the Christians expected him to do in rather short order, to establish the new kingdom as he said he would, according to the Bible. Paul, in his first letter to the Corinthians, advises those in love not to bother getting married because the time is short. That's a quote from 1 Corinthians 7:29. And quote, this world in its present form is passing away. This is in 51-52 AD, 1 Corinthians 7:31. This is what Paul is writing to his fellow Christians. The world is going to end right away. And it was not only Paul who thought that the end of the world was coming very soon. It was widely believed by Christians that the end of the world would come before all of the disciples died. Why did they believe this? Well, because Jesus had been quoted, was quoted in more than one place in the Bible as saying, quote, I tell you the truth, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the kingdom of God come with power. And that's in the Bible, not just once, but over and over again. Mark 9:1, Mark 13:30, Matthew 24:34, 35, and Luke 21:32. So this was a widely held belief. Jesus said, the end of the world is coming. My kingdom is going to be restored. And this is going to happen before the last person here dies. This belief was so widespread that when the disciple John, who outlived the others, when he died, someone had to add these verses at the end of the Gospel of John. And listen to see what kind of a plea this is. Quote, Jesus answered, if I want him, that is John, to remain alive until I return, what is that to you, that is to Peter? You must follow this. In other words, a person is adding at the end of the Gospel of John something to say, Jesus didn't say you will live until I die. What is it to you if that's what I said? Because of this, the rumor spread among the brothers that this disciple would not die. I'm still quoting from the Gospel of John. The rumor spread among the brothers that this disciple would not die. But Jesus did not say that he would not die. He only said, if I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? This is in John 21st chapter 23rd verse. So this is added on to the Gospel of John because it was widely believed that Jesus was going to return before the last disciple died, and the last disciple died. And so, oh, Jesus didn't say until I return, he will still be alive. But what is it to you if I said that? Almost 2,000 years later, and in a scientific age, which should undermine any notion that Jesus can come down from a heaven above the fixed stars, many people still say they believe these presently incredible ideas adopted by first century Christians. What is this faith that is so important to a religion like traditional Christianity? According to Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary, faith is, quote, firm belief in something for which there is no proof. The author of the book of Hebrews in the New Testament says in Hebrews 11:1, quote, now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see, unquote. So faith is a matter of believing something that you want to be true, whether you have any evidence for it being true or not. In other words, faith is firmly believing that something one hopes to be true is true, even though there's no evidence for it being true. Let me share with you my own transforming experience with regard to Christian faith. Some of you know that at one time I studied to become a minister in the Lutheran Church. That's how I happened to know so much about the Bible. If you know anything, you know Lutherans are really big on the Bible. So I studied a lot about the Bible. I even went to a Lutheran seminary for 1 year. I never, while I was growing up, had any questions about the ethical part of Christianity, about the need to love everyone, to forgive people who have done things that are wrong. But from the time I was a teenager, I had doubts about some of the doctrines, like the notion of the Trinity and about the reality of the miracles that are described in the Bible. And my biggest question of all was about the Easter story. That is the story of the resurrection of Jesus. After all, if I was going to be a minister in the church, it seemed to me that I had to find out the answer to this question. Is this story about the resurrection of Jesus really true or not? Did something miraculous really happen? Or did a small group of people just start to believe that it happened and then succeeded in persuading some others? In that connection, it's worth remembering that half of the New Testament is written by Paul, and Paul never knew Jesus. Paul did not become a Christian until a couple of years after Jesus was crucified. So that's a kind of an interesting situation right in itself. Now, why was this story of the resurrection so important to me? Three different things. One, because if that story is true, it would indicate that Jesus really is someone special, someone different in kind from other people. Secondly, because if it's true, it would show that miracles really can happen. That was obviously a miracle. Thirdly, because if it is true, it shows that life after death can be a reality. These are three extremely important beliefs. During that 1 year in seminary, one thing I did was to research as thoroughly as I could all the evidence and arguments on this issue, one side or the other. The biggest argument for the truth of the resurrection story is that it is hard to explain how the church got started if there wasn't a resurrection. I mean, what got these disciples going? At the very least, there must have been some people, maybe only a small group at first, but some people must have believed that somehow Jesus came back to life. Now, my conjecture, which I've not done much research to figure out whether this might be true or not, but my conjecture on this is that there may have, in fact, been an empty tomb, because Jesus' body was put in the tomb of Joseph Arimathea. And Joseph of Arimathea had this tomb that he was expecting to use for himself when he died. And I suspect that he just told some of his people, go and get Jesus' body out of there after a couple of days, because I want to be able to use the tomb myself when I die. But he didn't bother to tell the disciples about this. So they come and they, oh, golly, there's an empty tomb. And that, I think, might stimulate them to start thinking, oh, maybe Jesus didn't really die. Another aspect of this, when I was a graduate student at Washington University, I had the very good fortune during my first year there to live with a widow, a very wealthy woman, who had a huge house, had a maid and a chauffeur, and because her husband had died, didn't want to be in this big house all alone at night. So I had a free room while I was a student, just being there at night. But I do remember one time she invited me to have breakfast with her in her library, and her husband's name was Carl. And she said, you know, sometimes when I'm in this room, I feel like Carl is still here. And that's what the disciples might have felt when they were in certain places where Jesus had been with them. Oh, it's just like he's still with us. The biggest argument against the truth of the resurrection story, besides the inherent unbelievability of a story that someone came back to life after dying, is that some of the most adamant and influential early believers, like Paul, believed the story even though they never even knew Jesus, but nevertheless included their own experiences of the risen Jesus as equivalent to the experiences of the original disciples when they said they saw Jesus still alive. Paul experiences a vision of Jesus on the road to Damascus, in which he hears Jesus saying, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" And this particular incident is recorded 3 times in the book of Acts. Obviously, the huge event in the life of Paul, Saul changes his name to Paul, and this is on the basis of which he becomes a Christian. But since Paul had never seen Jesus, how could he know that this vision he was having was of Jesus? I mean, if he's never met Jesus, how does he know that it's Jesus that is speaking to him? Furthermore, this vision occurs long after Jesus had ascended into heaven, according to the Gospels. Yet Paul includes this vision of Jesus as comparable to the experiences that the other disciples had of the risen Jesus. So this, I think, makes it kind of debatable what kind of experience did those original disciples have. But as I was trying to figure out the answer to this resurrection issue, another even more important question occurred to me. Was it really appropriate that I would have to decide to become a minister on the basis of a true or false issue that might be decided rather definitely by some new discoveries that might show that it was false? For example, at that time when I was in seminary, the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls made me realize that other discoveries could be made that could show that the resurrection story was a hoax. What if I was a minister and scientifically people find new evidence that this was a hoax? What am I going to do? I mean, here my vocation shot down by some scientific discovery. Or what if someone would find the physical remains of what could be rather convincingly shown to be the body of Jesus? I mean, you know, my whole life would be dependent on some kind of belief about what had happened in the past. I said to myself, this believing or not believing the truth of a story about some incident in the past is not the sort of thing that should be the basis of one's religion or of the way one lives one's life. Instead of focusing on whether to believe this story, on whether to have faith in the truth of something for which there was good reason to be doubtful, something that may or may not have happened in the past, I thought, no, I should focus on the future and on what I want to do with my life, what I should do with my life. What should I do that I was rather confident would improve the world, whether the story of the resurrection of Jesus was true or not? What did I want to commit myself to doing? Furthermore, this was not just an issue of what vocation I should choose for myself. It was a new way of seeing what religion should be about. Religion should not be about what one believes, but about what one is committed to doing with one's life. The critical thing is not about believing or not believing some story that is supposed to be true, but rather about committing oneself to doing what is good. I know that others may have other commitments, but for me, I felt I could commit myself to educating others and to getting them to think for themselves about important issues instead of just accepting the propaganda that they happen to hear from others. That meant for me becoming a professor of philosophy rather than a minister. If I had known about Unitarianism at that time, however, I might have opted to become a Unitarian minister, but I certainly have no regrets. I can't imagine any vocation for myself that it would have been better than being a professor of philosophy. But my point this morning is not about what vocational decision I made, but about that insight I had about what religion should not be and what religion should be. Religion should not be about faith, about what one believes, about whether some particular event did or did not occur, or about whether miracles can occur, or whether there is or isn't life after death. That's not the right focus. Religion should be about personal commitment and what one intends to do with one's life to make the world a better place. It is about ideals to be pursued, not beliefs about what is true and false. Discovering which beliefs are true and which are false belongs to the realm of science, not religion. And arguing about which beliefs are true or false on those particular issues which are not resolvable by scientific experimentation, and there certainly are some of them, this is a task for philosophers. That's exactly what philosophy is about, is arguing back and forth on issues about what's true, but where science is unable to come to conclusions one way or the other. Commitment seems to me to be what Unitarian Universalism is really about. But we often have a difficult time throwing off some parts of our Christian heritage, like the focus on what do you believe. Let me hasten to add that there are parts of our Christian heritage, such as some of the commitments about what is good, that I don't want to throw out. In fact, I am proud to see that Unitarian Universalism is part of the Christian tradition and has got in itself the same kind of commitment to doing what is good for humanity. But I think we too much focus on beliefs about what is true and false, and that this has kept us thinking enough and doing enough about what is good. Sometimes we tend to get bogged down too much in which traditional Christian beliefs we do or don't accept. Others, but even we ourselves, get focused on what you use don't believe. We don't believe this, don't believe that. Many of us don't believe that Jesus was God incarnate. Many of us don't believe that Jesus was actually resurrected from the dead. Some of us don't believe in miracles of any kind. Some of us don't believe in life after death. Almost none of us believe that the world will soon end with Jesus actually coming down from the clouds to establish the kingdom of God on earth. But sometimes we use exercise more or better judgment than we realize. Even though we are, some of us, very much focused on what we do and don't believe. If we look at the purposes and principles of Unitarian Universalists, which we print on the back of our Sunday bulletins every week, these are not statements of any beliefs, but statements about our commitments. They unite us regardless of our diversity of beliefs. We, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote, one, the inherent worth and dignity of every person, two, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, three, acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations, four, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, five, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large, six, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. 7, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are part. Now, these purposes and principles are not a creed which all of our members must accept. But I am glad to be part of a church with such commitments and with no statements of beliefs which all our members must say they believe, whether they do or not.